It's a little after midnight here in the West, and we change gears now. I want to say thanks to Luis Elizondo for coming on the program. Gave us a lot to chew on there about the these mysterious craft of unknown origin, displaying technology that we don't have, made from materials that we can't make. A lot to chew on. I did not have a chance earlier in the program to mention some of the material we have on the Coast website tonight. Our webmaster, Greg Bishop, and I have culled together various items and oddities from media sources around the globe. We call it Naps News. You find it on the Coast website. Among the items out there tonight, an odd story from Wired about a reporter's drive to Skinwalker Ranch. Just kind of a weird piece. It's a bit of history about Bob Bigelow and his interest in UFOs. You have to check it out for yourself. And also a story about NASA stepping up the pace in its search for life on Mars. You'd think that would be a priority by now when we send missions to Mars. Let's see if there's life there. Also a think piece about just how powerful the big four Silicon Valley giants have become, where it could go from here. And kind of a cool story about female mediums, how they used spiritualism to advance the cause of equal rights. That and more on in Naps News. And while you're there, you can check out how to become a Coast Insider. The cost is pennies a day. It allows you to listen to the program pretty much anytime you want on any medium, as many times as you want. It's still a great deal. And while you're there, you can check out how to also subscribe to George Norrie's TV show, Beyond Belief. George is coming to Las Vegas in June. He's going to put on a stage show here. I'm going to join him for part of that. You can find that link on the Coast site as well. With that, we move on to our next segment. John Greenwald, back in 1996, at the ripe old age of 15, began researching the inner workings of the U.S. government, targeted the CIA, FBI, Pentagon, Air Force, Army, Navy, DIA, NSA, and other agencies using FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, to gain access to thousands of public records, a lot of stuff that otherwise would not see the light of day. His online archive called The Black Vault now has an astonishing 1.5 million pages of material and just added some new material. Long before we had ever heard of ATIP or BASS or To the Stars, there was Project Blue Book, the Air Force study of UFOs that ended in 1969. And some called it a study, some called it a whitewash. Some think it closed the chapter on serious investigation of flying saucers. Now we know that's not true. New information, though, has just surfaced, thanks to my next guest and a man he knows, documents that were supposed to be trashed decades ago. We'll find out what's in them and how they survived in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. It's always good to have John Greenwald on the program. It's been a long time, John. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure, George. It's good to be here.
Hey, did you get the chance to hear the first half of the program?
Sadly, I did not. I am fighting the flu, and I have spent the majority of today just trying to rest and get geared up for tonight. So I apologize.
Oh, man.
I did not hear it yet, but I'm going to definitely listen to the recording here this week.
Well, thanks for sticking it out with us. I know that, a lot of folks, you had questions, very legitimate questions about the disclosures from the Pentagon, the videos that came out. Give me your general take on that whole scenario.
Yeah, well, I followed the story quite a bit since it surfaced in December. And let me first say, I mean, you know, it's a fascinating news story. The fact that the government does admit that this program was real, I have no doubt that it was real. Mr. Elizondo coming out and talking about the details, I have a lot of, compliments towards him for doing that. But in the same respect, I have a lot of reservations, too, about the magnitude of the program, not to sound too much like a skeptic. But, you know, when you see conflicting media reports, and I call it copy and paste journalism, you know, there's a lot of red flags that come up for me just in the sense of what are we really dealing with here? You know, what is the ATIP program and what was it really saying? Because, I filed FOIA requests just like everybody else. I mean, it sounds like there's quite a bit that are going after, documents and so on. But one of the most blaring errors right up front was, you know, that the media just had the name of the program wrong. That when I said the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, they immediately corrected me on the phone. And I was talking with the Office of Secretary of Defense on the telephone. And they said, no, it's aviation, not aerospace. And so, I mean, those kind of things that start to come up start to ask questions like, okay, well, what's going on here? You know, why are we getting kind of varying facts when it comes to this story. And so I started filing FOIA requests. Some have come back, some have not. They're still open, trying to get my responses, what's called expedited under the FOIA, where if you put up a good case, they'll actually put you towards the front of the line. And I actually wrote a 27-page appeal, if you could believe it, on fighting for expediting the request. I put up a good case. I'm still trying to see what the outcome of that will be to see if they'll expedite it, because sadly, some of these answers may not come for a year or two, come until like a year or two from now.
And yeah, it takes a long time. I mean, in general,
it really does. And but look, it's a great story. I just, my reservation is largely how big was this? You know, and there are certain things that stick out, like the $22 million budget spread through 5 years, and you know, some want that this is going to be disclosure and this is the tip of the iceberg. And then when you really start digging in, it's like the DOD doesn't really have a whole lot of answers. They just kind of shrug their shoulders, and you know, with some of the FOIA answers, and they just really kind of didn't know where to go with some of it. And I was starting to get no records responses where there should have, you know, been at least something. So I'm still pushing forward to see what I can find. But again, fascinating story. I just have reservations on what the magnitude really is on this.
It strikes me as sort of like a lift up the tent and give you a look into the circus, just a glimpse, you know, and let's see what happens kind of a thing. Go ahead.
No. I mean, I think that there's a lot that still has to be addressed. And I can respect the situation where Mr. Elizondo is in, because he's had a career in government work and probably still has a clearance of some kind. I'm not sure how much, you know, he can really say on some of this stuff. So I can respect the position he's in, but it's just kind of, I think, frustrating for the public, because you do kind of get that peek under the curtain. Like you said, you see that there's something going on, you have more answers, and then you don't get them. You know, and I think that that's what the general public, especially the UFO community, wants, is not necessarily dangling a carrot and saying, well, there's a lot more, but we can't tell you. You know, not that Mr. Elizondo or the To the Stars Academy is necessarily doing that intentionally, but that's kind of where we're at. You know, we have a couple videos which, you know, could be very interesting, but we don't have a lot of the meat to the story yet. And so the question is, where is that meat? You know, and if the government does want this information out, then there should be more information coming from that side to at least confirm what's going on. And we don't have that yet. Not to say that it's not there and it's not coming. It's just we don't have that yet. And so that's where, again, my reservations come in. And I know I'm not alone in that as a whole, where, you know, there's others that are asking questions here as time goes by, where we want more, we want more. We're very selfish in the UFO community.
Well, we want more, we want it all, and we want it now. That's right.
Right. Yeah, and that's it. And to a point, you know, I think that if this is unclassified, or if the videos were declassified because they were classified at one point, then there should be more information that goes along with it or something else. And we don't have it yet. And again, from whatever side we're looking at, government or not. And so, you know, I think at this point we just kind of have to wait and see what is the government going to really confirm and come out with. And then, of course, Mr. Elizondo and the people at To the Stars Academy sounds like they have a lot more. And in fairness, since I didn't hear the last segment yet, you know, maybe they had a date of another release. So I definitely want to be fair on that. But before that, you know, there wasn't really any planned releases. So I'm one of the many that's anxiously awaiting to see exactly what comes next.
Well, you have so much experience with FOIA, using it as a tool to pry information out of the government, but you've run into roadblocks before, and I think this might be one of them. The unique nature of having a contractor, a private entity that does a lot of the work, the proprietary rights to the materials, the reports. Hal Putoff, who was here last month, had said, I think that Bass produced something like 78 reports, technical reports, and then case studies and things of that sort. It seems like maybe it's a structure that the Department of Defense has used before to create materials that are not FOIA-able.
Well, yeah, and that's going to be a gray area. Where I would respectfully disagree with that is that when you're, as a private contractor like a Bigelow Aerospace or a Lockheed Martin, when you're given taxpayer money, because obviously that $22 million is taxpayer money, when you're given the taxpayer money to do Project X, Y, or Z, the material that you produce is turned back to the government, and that is owned by the government and not that private corporation, because they're just contracted to do it. So, and I listened to that interview that you did. It was a great interview, and I believe it was like 38 technical reports that I remembered, because I actually FOIA'd them after that interview to see what, you know, what was going on. But if $22 million is given to, you know, Corporation X, and they're said to create reports Y, the reports Y are then turned back over to the government, and they are not copyrighted, and they would be FOIA-able. And so if all of that is assuming to be true, those reports should be the property of you and I, that they would not be Bigelow Aerospace's. Now, in the process of creating those reports, in fairness, Bigelow Aerospace may have material that they created internally that they used to generate the reports. But if they were contracted to create those reports as a whole, that final product is the property of you and I.
You know, I think one of the issues might be also, and this is just sort of guesswork, filling in the gaps, but if you had on the ground, boots on the ground investigators in the field collecting information, and you would give assurances to eyewitnesses or people who encountered something strange that their information is kept confidential, that could also be a reason for a delay in its eventual release, because you'd have to delete that private material, I would think.
Yeah, and that's called Exemption B6 under the Freedom of Information Act. That's all the privacy information that if somebody is, you know, living in a certain location, you want that private. Their names, you want that private. Telephone numbers, addresses, social security number, anything that might be personally identifiable is exempted. So yeah, that takes time to exempt. So that's definitely fair. And we even see that with the Project Blue Book stuff, you know, stuff that's 60 plus years old, that in itself is also redacted. So I'm eager to see, you know, how much material will come out. And sadly, if the government does not accept either my request for expediting or others who I'm sure are going after the same thing.
Including me.
Including yourself, yeah. I mean, we may wait a year, 2 years, 3 years. And sadly, one of the root organizations to the ATIP program, the Defense Intelligence Agency, I file requests to them like literally weekly or biweekly, and I've got quite a few open requests on all sorts of different topics. They are one of the slowest, sadly. They have a huge case backlog, and they take a long time to respond to requests. You know, 5 years is not uncommon, sadly, if you're going after something that has a little bit of meat to it. My record, not necessarily with the DIA, I forget exactly what agency, but my record is waiting 14 and a half years for a document to come. Now imagine how long that really is, you know, and it's frustrating at times. And again, going back to the ATIP program, you know, the DIA is one of the main agencies involved here. So sadly, they're going to take a long time. I'm hoping that, you know, my letter, again, 27 pages showing why this is something that justifies being expedited. If that's rejected, then I don't think we have a real big hope at all, because I tried real hard on that one.
Awesome. We're on the same page on that. I hope you get it, or I hope somebody gets it anyway. Let's move on. This new addition to the Black Vault is quite a story. Can you tell me how this came about?
Yeah, well, it's one of my favorites, actually, favorite stories here in the last 21, 22 years since I've entered the UFO field. And thanks to UFO investigator Rob Mercer, I actually met Rob a couple years ago and heard about this story where he had uncovered these lost Project Blue Book documents. Now, I'll be honest with you, I kind of doubted the story at first, because you always hear about these, you know, lost documents found, and I just kind of have no faith in stories like that. And after talking to Rob, I was producing a television series at the time. I work in television, and I was doing some research for this show. And it had touched on Project Blue Book, so I reached out to him, introduced myself, and we started talking, and then kind of lost touch for a little bit. We ended up not going down that angle for the show. Fast forward about a year or two, and here's a shameless plug, but I began a program on the Black Vault where I began a kind of an investigation arm to the blackvault.com. And what I mean by that is over the years, I've received countless UFO stories and all sorts of different cases. And so I launched this program to bring investigators together from around the world, launched it in December, and it's been doing very, very well. But in essence, it's to kind of look at these UFO cases that I was getting submissions from, again, from all over the world. And Rob had contacted me again after we hadn't chatted for a while, learned about my new program, and said, hey, I want to be involved. So he came aboard, and he's one of the investigators, and so we reignited the conversation about these Project Blue Book documents. And I said, hey, look, if you need a place to house these, because they weren't online yet, let me go ahead and do this for you. And so graciously he said yes, which I was very happy with, and we started building this archive. And the backstory to him is fascinating. He saw a advertisement on Craigslist, and it was about a box or two of Project Blue Book material that this person was selling for like $100 on Craigslist. Oh. He started doing some research, reached out to the seller, and the story behind them was they were found in a lot of lumber that was bought from a garage, and they were just kind of like behind all of this lumber that this person bought. So Rob, being the great investigator that he was, started tracking down who the root of this house was, meaning who owned it at the time, and potentially who had these boxes of material. And he tracked down that it was Lieutenant Carmen Morano, who was part of the Project Blue Book team that owned the house and had this material. And so Rob actually tracked him down, and it took a little while, and he reached out to him. And sure enough, not only did Rob buy those boxes that were on Craigslist, but Lieutenant Morano actually had more boxes that he had, I guess, in his attic or just in storage, and ended up sending quite a few boxes to Rob. I didn't know how big this really was, and meaning how voluminous it was, how much he had. I just thought it was maybe 50 or 100 pages. And Rob, on the contrary, had boxes of not only reports, letters, photographs, film reels, binders, books. I mean, you name it, Lieutenant Morano had saved it. And all of this material was from Project Blue Book, from literally the desks of Project Blue Book. And when it closed in the end of 69, beginning of 1970, all of this stuff was actually going to the trash. And so Lieutenant Morano, as a souvenir, wanted a souvenir, just decided to take it home. Now, I do want to point out all of this stuff is unclassified. There was nothing stolen or anything like that. The government has always maintained that Project Blue Book was unclassified. So he wasn't taking anything that he wasn't supposed to. This was just pre Freedom of Information Act, essentially. I mean, they were just going to trash this thing and get rid of it. And so Lieutenant Morano took it home, and there it sat for decades, and winded up being partially left behind in his home that he sold. Somebody found him after selling some lumber, found on Craigslist by Rob Mercer. Wow. He tracked it down, and there we go. So it's an amazing collection of documents.
It's like finding out the Lost Dutchman mine is real, or finding a magic lamp that you have to rub and a genie pops out.
Yeah, no, that's right. And what I was fascinated by, too, is that a lot of the stuff Rob had, because I just thought maybe they would be original documents that we've seen before, because there's not a whole lot with Project Blue Book that we haven't seen. And quite the contrary, it is a lot of material that has never been seen. And so I was kind of like a little kid in a candy store as Rob was sending me this stuff. I couldn't believe it. And I had reached out back out to him as we were kind of corresponding. And I said, have you done research on some of this stuff? Because, I mean, I don't think this has ever been seen before. And he says, yeah. He's like, I can't find it. And we've tried to cross-reference the main collection of Project Blue Book material at the National Archives, and a lot of it is not there, meaning this may possibly be the only copy in existence on a lot of this material.
Wow, we're talking with John Greenwald of the Black Vault about this new cache of Project Blue Book materials, documents, and film clips. When we come back, we'll find out what's in them, what it means. We're talking with John Greenwald about this cache of documents that and films and other materials that have surfaced from Project Blue Book. And a lot of folks would criticize Blue Book as a whitewash on the part of the Air Force, that they didn't give the UFO topic a fair shake. We'll get into that conversation, as well as the infamous Bolander memo that talks about where national security UFO cases should be rerouted and get John's opinion on that. But first, we're going to hear the story about what materials are in this this undiscovered or previously undiscovered pile of Blue Book materials in our next segment of Coast to Coast AM. So, John, you're telling us that UFO investigator Rob Mercer runs a search on Craigslist. What we left out was where the search was run. It's for Dayton, Ohio, right?
Correct, yeah, which is the home of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which is where Project Blue Book was headquartered. And that was the area that he lived in and found this advertisement in the area.
That makes a lot of sense to run that in that location. So Lieutenant Morano is the guy who brought the materials home, and Rob, your associate, tracks him down. Does he remember this stuff?
Yeah, he does. And he said that Rob had said after speaking with him, you know, it was quite a long time ago, so he doesn't remember, you know, every fact and statistic from Project Blue Book. And it's interesting to note that really he kind of had nothing of earth-shattering, you know, smoking gun things to say, meaning it was more of a historical narrative of what Project Blue Book was. Now, in my public speaking and in radio interviews with you, George, and quite a few others, when I talk about Project Blue Book, I've always supported that this was truly more of an explanation versus an investigation. So when you look at the documents, you kind of see that really they only had one aim and goal, and that was to pretty much settle the controversy, calm the nerves of the public, put the UFO thing to bed. It did not seem like a legitimate investigation at all. And so I think that that's really what the aim was. So when I came across meeting Rob and seeing these documents, it truly supported that. Meaning when you look at some of these documents that have never been seen before, and you see the tone that some of them are written in, you realize that they were not taking this seriously at all. And in fact, I'll bring up one. I mean, if anybody goes to theblackvault.com, you go to the archive list here, I believe it's linked directly from coasttocoastam.com as well. When you look at the index, you'll see case files, and there's two specifically that I'm referencing here from Florida. And the short of it is, I'll give you the subject line of the report. And it says, and I quote, UFO reports or the credulity, imbecility, gullibility, and or hysteria of some jerks of the current under 30 generation. Now, when you listen to that, how serious do you think that they really are taking the UFO topic when one military officer is referencing that line against their other fellow military officers? And this was a report where two other military officers had seen a UFO, and this was the start of the report. And it just, you know, it really sheds light on how serious they took it. And it is interesting to note that this report, and this isn't the only one that actually holds that identical subject line, they are not in the official files at the National Archives. So I've never seen these before. I mean, maybe they are hidden in some box somewhere. But I've never seen reference to something this strongly worded. But again, it really shows you how serious they took this.
Yeah, the mindset. It was really hostile to the topic and to eyewitnesses who come forward.
That's right.
So if it's not in the National Archives, I mean, do they come and ask for a copy of it? And it makes you also wonder what else isn't in there from Project Blue Book.
Well, we know that there are missing documents. I believe it's Special Report 13. Where, you know, there's these missing files that really may shed light on something other than the narrative that we're told. And that's been the basis of my research. This is pre-December of 2017 with the announcement of the ATIP program. But I've always supported that the UFO topic did not die in 1969 when they closed Blue Book. The documentation proves that it went on for decades. Some of the most highly classified UFO material is well into the 2000s, right? So all of that is easily proven. ATIP now is kind of reshaping all of that. Now we have a name, now that we see there's an admission that they're looking into the UFO topic. But since 2009, 2008 to date, I guarantee you that they were giving misinformation, meaning the government and military was giving misinformation to the public, saying that Project Blue Book was the end all when it comes to UFO investigations, and they concluded there wasn't anything to it. Yet in reality, we now know that that was not only a lie, but something that completely contradicts what they wanted us to believe. And so when you look at these documents, you realize that really Blue Book was not that investigation that they want us to believe either, that that they're making these, you know, wild subject lines and really ridiculous verbiage when they're describing UFO witnesses. And that's just something that really sheds light on how they viewed the UFO topic and the fact that they really just didn't care.
Well, I sort of agree with you that the ATIP revelation, it's not as big as we would like, or it's not as as fully open as we'd like, but the fact that it confirms in a sense that the study has gone on or there is additional collection of information is significant by itself. There's a, what we call the Bolander memo that you and I have talked about before. This memo that was released after Blue Book was canceled that says any UFO cases involving national security will continue to be handled by whomever.
Right.
Do you know whomever is? I mean, where those reports went or who handled them?
No, and it's never really been able to be determined. Now, post JANAP 146E, which is what was referenced in the Bolander memo, I had discovered an Air Force manual, which was called 10-206. Now, in short, this was something that was dated about 2008 when I had discovered it, and it was updated in 2009, 2010. And this specifically mentions unidentified flying objects and how to report them to United States Air Force officials. So this was not anything that you could debate. This was the agency that said that they didn't care about UFOs in one breath, but behind the scenes, they had a manual on how to report them. Now, when I tried to track down where these documents would go, I did discover that they went to the NORAD installation. So all UFO records made under Air Force Manual 10-206 went to NORAD. Now, when I filed a FOIA request to NORAD, I learned the hard way many years ago that NORAD is not subject to the Freedom of Information Act, mainly because they are under the control of the Canadian government as well as the United States. And so U.S. law does not apply. In that same letter, they said, well, in good faith, we searched for documents relating to your request, but we found nothing. So in other words, they were trying to honor the spirit of the FOIA, but they weren't subject to it, but they didn't find anything anyway. So what are the odds that, you know, this Air Force Manual 10-206 exists and not a single UFO report was submitted to NORAD ever, right? That doesn't make sense. It took me about a year to realize that in that letter was the answer. It was under the control of the Canadian government as well. And so I thought, well, why don't I go through the Canadian government? And sure enough, they have an equivalent to the Freedom of Information Act called the Access to Information Act. Now, I didn't know if a U.S. citizen could request information. So I picked up the phone and I dialed their equivalent to our Department of Defense, which is called the Department of National Defense in Canada. And these UFO reports, their acronym keyword is called CIRVIS reports, C-I-R-V-I-S, which stands for Communication Instructions for Reporting Vital Intelligence Sightings. Now, this was something that tied back to the Bolander memo and JANAP 146E. So it was like they were continuing the interest in UFOs. So when I called the DND and asked them in Canada, could a U.S. citizen request information, he kind of hummed and hawed a little bit. And he says, well, if it's been released before, I don't see why not. I said, great. Well, let me tell you what I'm looking for. And they're called these service reports. And it stands for communication instructions. And before I even got the acronym out of my mouth, he interrupted me and said, oh, yeah, I have them right here. And I practically fell off my chair because this wasn't a UFO office. He had no idea who I was. I never even introduced myself by name. Didn't know I was calling about UFO stuff. And within arm's reach, he had a stack of documents. And sure enough, I was able to get them. It was like the best $3 I ever spent on a Visa card. And he sent me a stack of about 100 service reports, most of them stamped with NORAD or type NORAD at the top, where they had to be sent through that agency that just sent me a signed letter saying they didn't have anything.
Oh, so, wow. Well, what was in them? What's in them?
Well, UFO reports. I mean, just bona fide flying saucers, discs, metallic shaped, lights in the sky, even a crop circle report. But it showed you that the government was here in America and in the United States, and the military was continuing the lie of their interest in UFOs. And that's going, you know, that's been the basis of kind of my research, is to show what they want us to believe, but only using their own information, completely contradicting it and blowing it out of the water. And this was a prime example that they were lying, because you can't, you know, you can't get away from that word, sadly. I've always tried to not say lying and accusing them of lying, but it's pretty black and white, literally black and white, in the letters that they sent me. So when you get these things from the Canadian government and they're willing to give it to you, it was a very interesting revelation. Now, one final thought on that, because this is the most fascinating part of the story. Lee Spiegel of the Huffington Post at the time, I know he's moved on from the paper, but he called me and was doing a story on the Black Vault and asked me for 5 documents that I found the most interesting. And I gave him a list, one of which was Air Force Manual 10-206. And he reached out to the Air Force for a response. And this was around a Tuesday-ish time frame of the week. And Wednesday comes and goes. They didn't call him back. He left a message. Thursday comes and goes. I know he left a second message. I had shown him how to get this manual, not only from me, but on the internet through the Air Force. When I had discovered it, it was not online. But as the years went on, they put it online. And so I told Lee how to get it from the Air Force, and he was even more fascinated by it because it was like hiding it in plain sight. And I remember that he called me on a Friday night, about 48 hours after his initial phone call to the Pentagon, and he says, "You're not going to believe this." And I said, "What?" And he says, "Air Force 10-206, Chapter 5, which is what I pointed him to, which had unidentified flying objects in black and white, was completely gone. And it was rewritten and now had to do with like hurricanes or something else." In other words, after he called and was about to put the spotlight on this thing, the Air Force completely rewrote it, completely deleted the chapter, reissued another publication. Then they called him back and said it was a coincidence that that happened, that they just haven't had any interest in UFOs, and that was it.
Well, it's amazing they would go to that much trouble at this point for something like that, isn't it?
It amazes me too. I don't understand it. And I was able to show, and this is an interesting part too, that they were constantly revising that manual. And my point with that, and why that's important, is that if UFOs were not of interest, I would have accepted the fact that maybe that manual was not updated, and that there it stood for years and years, but they just didn't care. And then when they got around to updating it, you know, they took it out. I could buy that. But on the contrary, I could show multiple revisions of that same manual. They never took UFOs out. So it was an active manual that they were completely revising every year or two. And it wasn't until the media was about to put a spotlight on unidentified flying objects that was listed in this manual. It wasn't until that time that they decided to delete the whole thing, all within 48 hours of his phone call. That, to me, is fascinating.
Also fascinating is the guy that you called having the files that you were seeking within arm's reach at that exact moment. That's a heck of a coincidence.
I kick myself for not asking why. But, yeah, you're right. Why would he have those, of all the things to have on his desk or within arm's reach, why those?
So one of the documents that I had pulled up from your archive there on the Black Vault, this new stuff of Project Blue Book, was about are UFO files open to the public? And there's some of that same kind of attitude hidden in this. The UFO files are not open to the general public, the document says, but they're open to bona fide news media representatives when they so request. And it says, "Our files are 7,000 cases. It's not possible to forward them to your group. There is no truth to the charges and allegations that the Air Force is withholding the truth from the American public. Our files are and have been open to media representatives, and in fact have visited the files and had complete unrestricted access to them." That's kind of hilarious and sad.
Yeah.
Your reaction?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because there are quite a few letters in there that shed light on how they were trying to treat this to the public, meaning how they were conveying the Blue Book material. And that is one of them. They always maintain that it was unclassified and that they would open it up to the media. But that in itself, I believe, supports that Blue Book was not necessarily investigating the good stuff. And the Bolander memo supports that as well, that anything that was truly a threat to national security was not part of Blue Book system anyway. And so that completely rewrites the whole scientific method of statistics when it comes to their overall investigation. And what I mean by that is they did, 12,600, I think off the top of my head, it was like 12,618 sightings. Only 701 of them remained unidentified. And they always maintain that they were unidentified because they didn't have enough information, that if they had more info, then they could determine it was the swamp gas or planet Venus or whatever they wanted to label it as. And so that's why I think it supports that this was just a PR campaign for the media to then report to the masses, we saw everything and it's all a joke. There is nothing to the UFO phenomena. Let's go ahead and move away from the hysteria and move away from the interest. Just go ahead and forget what we're doing in here and let's move on. And I think that that's what the Blue Book people wanted. But in reality, the real stuff, the good stuff, like the Bolander memo says, was funneled somewhere else. Where that is in that time frame, sadly, no one's ever been able to see.
It's kind of cool that you found photos of the lieutenant during active duty, that you found memos that specifically addressed to him about his duties during the study. It sort of verifies steps along the way that these are legit.
That's right. And that's compliments to Rob Mercer on his investigation, because he's the one that really verified, whether or not this was real or not. And he did his due diligence because, again, there's a lot of people that hoax stuff. Why they would hoax this, I'm not real sure. But there is that fear. And Rob did great work kind of doing the background. And one of the more infamous photos of the Project Blue Book staff, which they were often ridiculed for, was a picture of just four of them, where Hector Quintanilla was in the front sitting at a desk, and his receptionist, I think was secretary, was off to his left, and you had a couple other guys in the background. That Lieutenant Morano was actually in the background in the center. That was the man that Rob Mercer had found. So it was a very cool tie-in to the history of Project Blue Book.
I want to ask you about one of the documents. I'm not sure we're going to have time before the break, but it's about the Smithsonian Institute and UFOs. Always wondered what kind of interest. I'm not able to open it right now, but maybe you could tell us what's in there when we come back. Smithsonian, if you've been there in recent years at the Air and Space Museum, has an ongoing questionnaire where they ask people what they think about. I can't remember if it's UFO question or ETs, but the number of responses they've collected and the overwhelming sentiment of the public is that they take it seriously. They think it's real. And it's interesting that you have a reference to some documents regarding Smithsonian and UFOs in this. And when we come back, I want to hear about that. We're talking with John Greenwald, the Black Vault, about this cache of Project Blue Book documents. On the other side, we'll be opening up the phone lines with your questions, calls, and comments as well. Stick around.